From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, there's something missing here. What it is will be exactly clear very soon. I'm Rex Smith. Welcome to The Media Project. Kaylin Brown is here, professor at the College of St. Rose. Dr. Brown.
I would like to operate on everyone's sentences this morning.
And you brought your red pen to do so. She has a light-up red pen. What a piece of work that is. Wow.
Thank you, students.
Okay. Judy Patrick is here, former editor of the Daily Gazette and vice president of the New York Press Association, right?
It is great to be here once again.
We're going to talk about your recent trip momentarily here. And Barbara Lombardo, a longtime editor of the Saratogian, now teaching at the University of Albany. How you doing?
Hello. Doing well, thank you.
And Dr. Shartok is nowhere to be seen, having fled the premises. And I know.
In terror. He ran out of the building. It was crazy.
Yeah, I know.
Temporarily.
He saw you three coming in here, and he said, I'm getting out of here. I know it's good for me anyway.
Watch it, Rex.
Thank you, David. Sounded just like him. All right. That is David Gustina, our esteemed producer. So, Judy, you've just come back from New Zealand.
I have. You know, I went to New Zealand because my niece, who's in her mid-20s, was hiking the Te Aroha Trail, which is this 800-mile trail from the tip of the South Island. It actually goes to the tip of the North Island. She just did the South Island. I wanted to meet up with her, see some of the landscape. But a day or two after I left, there was that terrible terrorist attack in Christchurch.
Terrible attack, which posed some real challenges for journalists. Consider the almost unique situation that it presented. There have been a lot of videos of terrible crimes. This one, however, was actually shot by the perpetrator. And it was being sent out live, and so very many places actually had it. You could download it on YouTube and so on. And while social media raced to get rid of it, nevertheless, journalism organizations had access to it and had the option of using it. What do you think? If you each had been running newsrooms at that time with international news as a focus, would you have used that as part of your news report?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, that's a pretty easy question. No.
Yeah. Why not? Isn't giving people the vision of the horror part of the experience of giving people the reality of what goes on?
Yes. And that's what makes it such a difficult question, because we want to tell the news. We want to show what really happened. We want to share the horror, and nothing really does that as well as visuals. But the responsibility that we have to, as decent human beings, there has to be a line drawn.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's right.
Think
that's, even in the code of ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists, and Alan always makes the self-serving noise when I talk about this, but there is, you know, the third element of it.
Minimize harm.
Is minimize harm. It doesn't
I'm
mean do no harm, which is the Hippocratic Oath, but it does mean that to the extent that you can, within your truth-telling responsibility, minimize the harm you could cause others. And so I think that's why we have human beings making these decisions.
It makes
algorithms.
It difficult when everyone in the media is not on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
And that weighs into, I think, editors' decisions on what to do or what not to do. If everyone else is doing it and you're the only one not doing it.
Well, what if you are? Imagine that you're the editor of the New York Daily News and you see that the editor of the Crosstown tabloid, The Post, might be using some of this more horrendous stuff.
You know, just because your friend jumps off the cliff doesn't mean you should jump off the cliff. In this case, the gunman was purposely broadcasting. It was a theater on his part. So his intentions were to distribute this. And when the media distributes it and helps him, they're buying into what he's trying to do. I think in some respects, editors trust their gut. And as soon as I started to watch that video, I said, nope, don't want to watch this. This is too brutal, too inhumane. This is not something that I want to see and that I want my family or my community to see.
What about the dissertation on his political ideology, the so-called manifesto? Is that useful to publish?
Not necessarily. It reminds me of our homegrown terrorist, the Unabomber from the Schenectady, New York area, where he had wanted a manifesto. I think that the media's decision not to run that after analysis, when they were doing a content analysis, was extremely important. The media should not be kowtowing to these terrorists. There are other reasons not to use the content that's generated from social media. I think it's very fair to say that content on social media does not at all represent reality. In fact, it represents an alternate universe. I get a lot of frustration over social media. I don't think it's been contributing to the public conversation. And what Judy said about not watching, I think, is also really important. I remember when Danny Pearl was beheaded over in the Middle East, and I had met him, and there was no way I was ever going to watch that. But I would never watch any of that. And I think our listeners have an obligation to edit themselves. If they don't want to see certain content and they decide and they talk back against it, that may move the meter.
That may be the case. But don't you want to, with respect to the political manifesto, isn't there a responsibility of journalists to try to help explain what is behind an action? Like, what was the gunman thinking when he opened fire in two mosques?
Right. You want to understand what they're thinking, but part of our responsibility is to boil down what he said. And I don't think we have to feel obligated to give him the type of audience that he was seeking, and because it just encourages more.
You know,
You know, the New York Times talked about that they were going to go in and annotate it, like they do for many of these complicated manifestos. But then they realized that they were just playing into the terrorist hand. I started to read it too, and I said, "This is silly. This it's so packed full of inside jokes, and he's playing to his, you know, demented audience that it's not worth reading." I think people want to know why gunmen, terrorists do what they do. But again, I agree with Barb that one of our jobs is in journalism is to explain things to people.
Okay, now here's another question, though, that comes down to something that does confront a lot of us often. The perpetrator of the crime, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, said that she is not going to use the suspect's name in order to not give him notoriety. What do you think about that? What should the media's response be? Should we be not using the name of perpetrators of significant crimes? I have often heard from readers who have urged that in mass shootings in the United States, for example, let's not use the name of the shooter because others who may want to ape that behavior will see the notoriety that person is getting and want to have it also. So should we avoid using the name and publishing the photograph?
I did read some more about that, and I would say that we should limit that. I think that naming the individual once on the inside for hard copy or way down, a photograph way down again, played once possibly, I think it's better to err on the side of caution. If the media has any sway in how these terrorist attacks are taking out, which they clearly do based on what happened in Christchurch, he was orchestrating that entire event to be online. The media can edit and make its own decisions. We're not going to use that and tell the readers, this is why. You know, went into my classroom this week and said, what news do you want to talk about? And my student wearing her hijab said, I want to talk about New Zealand. I'm looking at this kid. She's a teenager, and she has the bravery and integrity in the classroom to do that. The only person who said in class, I'm a Muslim and this matters to me, and she was so afraid to go out the entire weekend. She told the whole class, I didn't go out of my house. We are contributing to that, the media, when it overcovers and exploits and uses wretched excess. So that's my diatribe for the day.
What do you do, though? What think about the Sandy Hook massacre, when doing exposition on the background of the shooter contributed to the public policy debate, didn't it? Because that is really what led to some of the talk about red flag legislation, legislation that would give the government the authority to go in and seize the guns from people with some apparent mental defect.
I think you can tell the story about the background of the person, what they seem to have been thinking, why they did what they did, how they grew up, and nobody would have ever suspected they would have done such a thing, or he was odd and somebody did suspect he would do such a thing, without glorifying the name. Now, I don't know how much in the mind of the people who commit such atrocities, I don't know if they're thinking that they want their name out or just their actions out, but if it's the name, you play the name rarely and low in the story.
Mm-hmm. You know, in some respects, it illustrated for me the importance of using a name, because early on there were four people allegedly arrested, and I stepped away from the news and I came back, and the radio report wasn't naming the person. I'm thinking, is that the gunman or is that someone else? So there is some value into using a real name in a limited circumstances. Certainly when they indict them, they're going to have a name on the indictment. It's basic information that we need to know. To be honest, I don't remember the name of the Sandy Hook killer at this point.
You know, Lanza.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Better memory than I.
It was said a lot of times. That's why I remember. I don't have a great memory, but I remember that because I read it and read it and read it.
But I think basic information is good. It's the glorification. And I don't think mainstream media does glorify mass killers like this. I think there are some types of media that do, but it's not responsible media doesn't typically do this.
Not glorify, but we do write a lot about them. I do think, though, less in recent years than perhaps 20 years ago.
You know, I also think this is a way of diverting blame. Everybody's trying to figure out why this is happening, and it's easy. You know, we're very good scapegoats at this point.
I think that's a really good point. There's no one else that you can turn to and blame, so why not attack the media? After all, everybody does. And not for your little violins to come out, listeners, but I do think, though, you have to differentiate between that and, say, crimes such as an assassination. We all knew immediately a lot about Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963, those of us who were alive at that time, and that's appropriate, and we would delve into the background and that kind of thing. So somehow there is a difference, and again, these are human decisions that are done in the newsrooms.
Well, the motivations of the killers, are they targeting one person, or are they, you know, blanketing dozens and dozens of innocent people?
Mm-hmm. Key thing, I think, is probably in situations like this, in these mass shootings and things where there is a seemingly a political motive, to bear in mind that the media manipulation is often a key element of how these violent extremists plan their activities and why they undertake them at all. And if we can begin to establish some standards, it's hard to say this because the barriers to entry and to the media are very low. Publishers are anybody who has access to the internet, you know. And so those of us in the mainstream media who may have these standards won't really be able to control access. But to the extent that we can, if we can thoughtfully limit this kind of coverage, that's the right thing to do, right?
Right. You know, let's talk about the platforms like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and what they need to do. They need to have a real conversation about how instantaneously people can post content. I mean,
to get it off.
Yeah, and how to get it off. When we started to do Facebook Live, I can tell you that there was a moment where I'm thinking, well, we're going to do this live. What if someone says something they shouldn't say live on air? I mean, even at this radio station, there's a delay. When you talk to teenagers growing up, you say, think before you talk. I think the platforms need to be held responsible, and they need to have a real conversation about how they operate going forward.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And social media for many years has held to the myth that it's not journalism. It's just a neutral platform passing along content. We are seeing that they are beginning to take on responsibility. There are finally more editors, though you may not want to call them that, being hired by Facebook, by Google. That's appropriate, isn't it? And we need to hold them somewhat responsible.
In the old-fashioned print way, newspapers, I remember it was that way at the Saratoga, and Rex and Judy, you can tell me if it was like this at your papers, that when we would start having blogs on our websites and we would not touch what was on the blog and we would hold our hands up and say, well, we're not responsible for what idiotic, horrible things might be said on those blogs. We don't edit them. So that was almost like a lower tech pass-through or abdication of responsibility for what we're telling the public.
Yeah, we struggled with that at the Times Union. We had a couple hundred community blogs on timesunion.com, and even though each one of them said at the top, the Times Union is not responsible for this, nevertheless, the Times Union logo stood up there at the top. That kind of reached a bad point for us when somebody posted shortly after, I believe it was shortly after the inauguration of Donald Trump, that the University of Albany had invited Sarah Palin to be the graduation speaker and to give her an honorary doctorate. People didn't notice at first that it was April the 1st. It was a Times Union community blogger who was sharing a joke, but it wasn't a joke to UAlbany because people were calling right away and saying the Times Union is reporting this. So we
are trying not to laugh.
Yeah, right.
Right now.
So the executive producer of TimesUnion.com immediately shut down that blog, and we have cut back the number of blogs we're hosting. And it's not as popular medium now anyways it used to be. People aren't paying as much attention to that stuff.
But in education, our students who are producing content for the journalism blog, the Pine Hills blog on the Times Union so generously hosts, they are very appreciative. And the neighborhood is appreciative and invites the students, the journalism students, to neighborhood meetings. They're giving us all the information to cover them. And I might add on the low bar part about getting into the media. So what's changing in the field of education in some respects is how students are being prepared to get out in the media market. We have a critical media studies concentration when paired with an ethics focus, a minor. I was talking to one of my students at Advisement Day. I said, you're ready for Silicon Valley. Be prepared to teach them ethics out there.
Yeah. That's,
and so we're training students to know how to behave ethically and train other people to do that.
Yeah, that's very, that's the other side of it. That is the great thing about the low bar to entry into the media. I mean, it does empower a lot of people. It, you are publishing, these students are actually publishing their work and communities are being covered. So maybe the responsibility is just on those of us who run platforms to thoughtfully handle them, administer them, edit them, prepare them, whatever the proper verb is here. So anyway, if you're just joining us, this is The Media Project. We are here with Kaylin Brown, Barbara Lombardo, and Judy Patrick. I'm Rex Smith. And we do have, by the way, some mail from our listeners on the point that we were just hitting. A listener named Matt, talking about the so-called manifesto from New Zealand, refers to that as an internet meme. You know, a meme, he says, is information that is designed to be copied and repeated. So he says the word manifesto, which really was just filled with white supremacist memes, and reporters didn't really sort out the context. And so we end up spreading the memes further. So his argument was, don't take the manifesto, so-called, seriously, put it in quotes, and don't repeat the meme. Another example was the Momo Challenge, which turns out to really be a hoax. This sense that a whole lot of young people were killing themselves in response to doctored YouTube videos. This was a couple of weeks ago.
I did hear it happen. Yes. I didn't pay attention to it because it reminded me of the Tide Pod Challenge where kids were eating Tide Pods. And I prefer not to know this information.
And it turns out not to be true. A lot of people were not, in fact, eating Tide Pods, and children were not, in fact, killing themselves. But it was an internet meme that turns out not to be true. So thanks, Matt, for drawing that to our attention. Another person writes in about the use of the word flack that we talked about last week. One of the public relations professionals took exception to that. And Dave in Boston, who says he's a loyal listener. Thank you very much from Boston. Dave purports to give us the etymology of it, but it ends up concluding after many different rumors, including that there was a well-known movie publicist in the 1930s whose name was Eugene Flack. Who knew? And that's what led to the use of the verb, but there are all kinds of other things. Ultimately, finally, Merriam-Webster comes down and lists the etymology of flack as unknown. So what can you do about that? And in that regard, by the way, I last week defended public relations professionals, people who actually make their living by giving information to reporters. And I want to note the passing of my dear friend Sean Casey, who was with Mohr, the largest public relations firm upstate New York, who was a professional all the time in his dealings with the media. And we appreciate that kind of person, you know, on the other side of the notebook.
Sean Casey was such a force in our Albany market. He repeatedly took interns, and Mauer still will. I spoke with Brendan Kennedy. Sean Casey was a gem, a professional. He had the best sense of humor. He loved to encourage young people in the field, and it was such a good energy to send a senior down for their internship and to see them working so closely with Sean. So
it was. It was.
We will miss him.
A great thing, absolutely. And to that extent, maybe some of you who, since you all are engaged in one way or another in academia, I guess, maybe you can help explain to our listener, Albert, who's on Broadway in New York, is grateful for the show and says the topic about the term flack made me wonder about what I've long thought to be an odd practice by universities of putting public relations and journalism in the same degree program. An upside of that mix is that students might better understand the agendas of all sides. A downside would be adding legitimacy to the public relations business whose goal often is to control the news, he says. So this is an interesting question. What do you think about the pedagogy of putting them all together?
Well, I think that the origins is all about the money. And people who might think they're interested in journalism might also want to have a normal life, be able to afford to pay the rent, move out of their parents' house. So there's an appeal to public relations or the concept of, you know, communications in some way, shape, or form. So I think the merging, there is some sense to it because a lot of the skills are the same, and it's helpful to understand each other's roles. So there is some sense in having that, the news gathering, the synthesizing, how to communicate, how to interview, how to relay the information. There are connections to that. I did find it unsettling when that first started to come about, where it became almost more of an emphasis on PR people. My alma mater for my master's was Ohio State, and for the journalism program, you know, it became more and more of a PR branch. And so it's unsettling but understandable, I guess.
So as a human who works in a school where we have five concentrations, which include both journalism and public relations, as well as film and new media and critical media studies, did I name all five? So I was unsettled when I first started working with my public relations colleagues, but I've always worked with public relations colleagues in some way because as a reporter, that's what we did. I am completely come to terms with the fact that there is a synchronicity there because of the following. When you are a freshman and you come into college and you have managed to figure out that you want to be a communication major or a communications major, that is a hard decision in itself. I think we can all agree at 18. What do you want to be? Who knows? So many things. But they get in, they see communications, and then they start to sample the different disciplines, and that's how they decide. It is a rare human who goes into college and knows the path they want to take.
Mm-hmm. But don't you find it exciting when you have promising students in your class who they're excited by the concept of journalism, seeking out, as the Society of Professional Journalists would note in their ethics, seeking the truth and reporting it, that there's excitement when they really have it in their belly, the hunger in their belly to do those kind of work.
They get so excited about it. And can you imagine that there are students excited about the freedom of information law? So much so that Mark Mahoney over at the Gazette, who was visiting my class a few weeks ago with Mike Spain, formerly of the Times Union, Mark invited the students to write a story about Sunshine Week, the week that we all acknowledge as a time to celebrate access to meetings and open government. They wrote a good story, and they were very excited about doing it because they do really care. And a shout out to Soraya Sargentin, this year's winner of the Journalism Award.
Cool. Mm-hmm. How about that?
I'm going to have to do a better job promoting University at Albany next time I'm here. And our ethics, one of our ethics.
Please don't.
Well, the news editor for WAMC, Ian Pickus, is teaching the ethics class this semester.
Oh, that's good. That's a good thing. Finally, this week, we need to say something about the President of the United States. I mean, after all, what would a media show be if we don't talk about the man with orange hair? The President.
It would be better. I'm answering that. I would like to ask us not to. Why don't we talk about FOIA and how many EPA FOIAs there were? Go ahead. It's your show.
Oh, thank you. I just want to, there's a terrible policy issue here where he tweeted, "It's truly incredible that shows like Saturday Night Live, not funny, no talent, can spend all of their time knocking the same person and me over and over, blah, blah, blah. Should Federal Election Commission and or the FCC look into this?" That is, seeking to have a federal agency explore the content of a program on a major network. I guess you're right, Kaylin. Maybe we should just ignore this kind of thing.
No, you set it up for me, Rex. A federal agency is exploring the content on media platforms. They're exploring the President of the United States' tweets and whether he's violating the law. So let's leave it at that.
There you go. Absolutely true.
But there's also the issue of the President of the United States, who essentially is the boss of the Federal Communications Commission, basically telling them to take a hard look at this, and this is censorship, and this is not what this country is about. And too often his tweets are so stupid and so that, you know, we just let them fly over our head. But they really need to be, he needs to be held to account. And we as a society need to say, no, the president should not be doing this.
It is a tough choice, I think, between Kaylin's approach, which is we can't keep focusing on this thing. And what Judy is saying is, no, we need to, because otherwise we get inured to the danger that it poses. Anyway, we'll come back and talk about that more another day, I'm sure. So the Media Project, we have been very grateful to have you here. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, Kaylin Brown, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us.
This show should be an hour.
Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Kaylin Brown is chair of the Department of Communication at the College of St. Rose. Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. And Barbara Lombardo is a journalism professor at the University at Albany and former executive editor of the Saratogian and the Troy Record. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.